Thank you very much, Gopal. Our next speaker is Mary Ann Mercer, who is a senior lecturer at the University of Washington Department of Global Health, and also is a senior MCH advisor at Health Alliance International, both in Seattle. She is interested in the effects of globalization on health and co-edited a book on that topic. She also blogs for the Huffington Post, which I would highly recommend that you look up. So, Mary Ann.
Thank you.
So thanks a lot, Laura. And Gopal, that was a fabulous introduction to what I will be talking about. I will try to kind of skip through, we haven't seen each other's presentations, so I'll kind of skip through the things that he's spent more time on and focus more on the sort of the end result, but like what we can do. So no conflicts to declare. So I'll talk about a little bit about these early life effects on infant and adult health, but try to focus more on possible interventions that we that are involved with MCH programs could do, and that certainly we will hope that the Sustainable Development Goals will also include. So early life, as Gopal pointed out, that period beginning with conception and continuing through the first 2 years. But as he also pointed out, that the indicators of early life tend to be growth and development. Low birth weight is a key indicator, but what I think is really important to understand is that it's just an indicator. It's not the weight itself that causes the problems. It is an indication that there is something wrong during the whole period of, well, probably at the beginning, but also during the period of gestation and during those first, say, roughly 2 years of life. So I'll just briefly go through these factors, which I think Gopal has already mentioned, maternal nutrition, but also some other issues that affect early life probably pretty dramatically. Mental health issues, domestic violence, and then the postpartum postnatal effects. So you've probably all seen this chart that really illustrates, again, the things Gopal talked about, that a low birth weight infant, it doesn't begin with, you know, if they are low birth weight, it's probably part of a cycle. The cycle of failure of the child growth, failure of then the teenager, sometimes early pregnancy, but it's very clearly a cycle, and it's a cycle that is going to be very difficult and will take a long time to actually overcome. What happens when women's health and when women's nutrition is bad? These are just some figures from the two poorest areas of the world, South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, and you can see it's pretty bad. And South Asia being pretty substantially having lower a nutritional status than Sub-Saharan Africa. So, you know, five times the rates of stunting, three times the rates of underweight, twice the rates of just sort of thinness, et cetera. And that doesn't have to do with age at first marriage, which are about the same, or with fertility rates, since fertility is actually higher in Sub-Saharan Africa. So what happens when the mother is nutritionally disadvantaged? Well, you can see South Asia, twice the rates of low birth weight as Sub-Saharan Africa, which is already, again, higher than it is in the developed countries. So when you think about interventions, particularly in South Asia, to improve health and to reduce chronic diseases, it's going to be a rough haul. So what about maternal mental health issues? This little guy knows when mom is upset, and it actually reduces, it slows him down a lot, him or her. This is a fairly recent study, review actually from several sources showed that somewhere between 20 and 60% of women in the world state that they have anxiety or depression. So it's a major, those are the developing countries. Higher, much higher in developing countries than in the developed. So if you think about that this is going to have an effect on infants, again, we've got this major problem to overcome, and in fact, fair amount of research showing that depressed or anxious mothers have 3 or 4 times the rate of low birth weight. So here we go. We know that low birth weight is a problem. So it has to do with nutrition, but it also has to do with these other factors in a woman's life, particularly during the pregnancy. There's a lot of interesting and stuff looking at research going on. What is it? You know, why does that happen? And probably it's, you know, at least one of the major factors is the mediating role of cortisol. Cortisol being a stress hormone, it's definitely higher in women who are stressed, and they can actually increased cortisol levels in the amniotic fluid of a woman who is stressed. That seems to reach the infant, and it changes, seems to change the infant's ability to respond appropriately to stresses. There's also a lot of really interesting stuff in the size and the composition of the placenta. You know, that was always something we just threw away, but it's actually being studied a lot more than it used to be, and seems to have some indications. So this other, you know, another important factor for conditions of pregnancy is women that are undergoing domestic violence. So 35% of women in the world say that they are, or at least recently have, experienced domestic violence. And that's a huge number. Now, this WHO report said 16% a greater likelihood of low birth weight for a woman who reports anxiety or depression. I mean, I'm sorry, who reports domestic violence, and an even greater risk of preterm birth. And we had a student at University of Washington last year who was very interested in domestic violence, and she looked at the demographic and health survey from Timor-Leste and did a pretty sophisticated analysis of the domestic violence, whatever the module is called. They ask about perceived birth weight. Was your baby normal size? Bigger than normal? A lot bigger than normal? Smaller than normal? A lot smaller than normal? And in Timor-Leste, women who had said they had a smaller than normal baby, if they were reporting domestic violence, and we suspect there are a lot that don't report it, but 3 times greater risk of having a smaller baby. So again, think of the importance of this for a country where we're trying to improve the health of the children, the infants, and we know they're already going to be put at risk just from this factor that's not nutrition. It certainly relates to nutrition, but it's an additional factor of early life. And I won't go through these too much because Gopal covered them very well. Certainly the whole area of infant and young child feeding and growth is a very important early life condition, as well as the whole issue of maternal attachment. And there's a lot of studies around the fact that maternal stresses, particularly depression, affects the mother's ability to bond. So you kind of imagine being a new mother, a mother of a small child, and just struggling with your own problems in daily life and in trying to really form this attachment with the baby, and it's found to be very difficult. Again, cortisol seems to be a kind of a mediating factor there relating to difficulties of attachment. And then certainly long-term effects are clear. So what are the effects of the first 1,000 days? As Gopal pointed out, I mean, there is early life lasts a lifetime. So this particular chart I find impressive, but there are tons like it. This is not an unusual finding. But basically this shows on the, I don't know if you can even see the bottom line is birth weight, and it starts at less than 5 pounds and goes all the way up to 10 pounds. So this is the risk, the age-adjusted relative risk of coronary heart disease and stroke. In this study called the American Nurses Study, which is this huge, long term, it's still ongoing, hundreds of thousands of women. So these are pretty reliable data. And as you can see, it's not just about low birth weight even. It is at every increase in birth weight, there is a reduced risk of these chronic diseases. And in other charts you'll see it's fairly similar for these other major chronic diseases that Gopal had mentioned. So we got, this is a big barrier to overcome, if we're starting to see this increase in chronic diseases in developing countries, we got a lot of work, and it's going to take a long time. These are just some of the problems that are they're shown to be increased, and I think Gopal's already gone over them. Basically, the common diseases of what we used to think of as old age. This is just a chart that shows the stages of antenatal development when different organs are formed, and some of them pretty much for the entire, at least first half of the pregnancy. When there's an intense insult in the very first part of the pregnancy, so like in the ones on the left are heart, upper limb, lower limb, you know, those kind of deformities are more often with an early problem, but the functional problems that we're talking about are probably later, something that occur later on. Okay, so just get to thinking. Now, these are just some of my ideas, and I think Gopal can talk about the men's issues as well later on, but some, just a couple of ideas about what can we do, what could we do. I run an MCOH program in East Timor, and I keep thinking about how can we help those programs to be more effective. And one of them, I feel very strongly, would be to improve antenatal care. I mean, remember the old days, we used to have risk factors. We had this risk assessment where if women were short or small, they were at high risk and they were trying to, you know, go for special care and all that. But we got rid of that because it didn't predict obstetric complications. But guess what? It still does predict problems in the child. It predicts developmental problems in that child as it grows older. And so we could still use a risk category. We could add things like a screening for maternal health problems, a screening for, you know, domestic violence, and include those in antenatal care, and we would actually be doing something to affect early life. I don't think there's much we do in antenatal care right now that really that affects these early life factors. And clearly, obviously, we need to develop probably community-based services to address those problems, and that would certainly include nutritional support. Miriam's going to talk about breastfeeding, so I won't say much, but, you know, we all know the incredible nutritional benefits of breastfeeding, but there's also just the skin-to-skin contact, a lot of evidence about the benefits for the development of the child, and also for the mother, the interesting association between breastfeeding and depression. If a mother breastfeeds, she's less likely to be depressed. If she gets depressed, she often will quit breastfeeding, and so it certainly is beneficial for the mother's well-being. So those are clinical interventions. What else could we do besides clinical things? Well, I think one big area of intervention that's vastly underused is home visiting. Doesn't have to be home visiting with nurses, midwives, doctors, whatever, but home visiting by anyone with a basic level of training. There's a lot of research now showing that well-trained lay people, they've improved antenatal care use, depression rates, breastfeeding, mortality rates, etc. There was this very interesting set of studies in Jamaica where they did these weekly home visits, just layperson helping the mother play with the child. And 20 years later, they went back. I mean, this is unusual because you don't see these kind of evaluations. 20 years later, they went back and found that if it was an early intervention, it had to be before the child was 18 months of age. Higher educational attainment, higher IQ, fewer mental health problems, actually higher earning power. So pretty substantial effects just of getting that, you know, just helping the mother with that one aspect of her care of this infant. And then another area that I think we're starting to see, Gopal talked about men's and women's groups, and I'm sure those are useful, but just these participatory, we got a lot of research now, a lot of places where they've tried participatory women's groups, have shown, you know, dramatic effects on things that weren't even predicted, but certainly maternal care practices, a reduction in, newborn mortality, reduction of maternal deaths, etc. And there's a study in India, a 57% decrease in maternal depression. So if you realize that's an important factor in child health, you know, again, women's groups, which are not an expensive intervention. They're something that can be done if they're well planned. We do need more information, I think, about how do you run a women's group that actually will improve things. It's not going to be about standing up and lecturing. It'll have to do with getting them involved. But think about, if a woman needs support in taking care of these major problems in her lives, talking to other women is actually a very empowering kind of thing. And of course, it wouldn't make sense to also not think about these really big picture issues. Obviously, poverty reduction, including cash transfers, either conditional or unconditional, have been shown to be very effective. Girls' education, clearly, domestic violence, and I was very happy to see that one of the sustainable development goals will have to do with this idea of empowerment of women, improved status of women, because that really probably is the most essential thing in the long run that would kind of take care of all these problems. So to the extent that we can do this, improve conditions of early life in this 2015 period, we will improve health for everybody. And until we do that, the burden of chronic disease as well as infant and child health problems is going to will be growing into the future. Thank you.